From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gustina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Coming up this week, state budget negotiations collapse and Governor Cuomo explains why. Our political observer Alan Shartok will share his thoughts on the politics of the late budget, an activist rally in Albany in support of a bill to create a universal publicly funded health insurance plan for the state. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. State budget negotiations collapsed in New York this week after the state Senate left the Capitol without agreeing to a deal with the Assembly or Governor Andrew Cuomo. Top lawmakers said they were close to working out disagreements on juvenile justice reform, education spending, and other sticking points. Addressing the press on Wednesday, the governor explained what issues are holding up the budget agreement.
What we don't have in place yet is a raise the age is not yet complete. Affordable New York, which is a new and improved version of the old 421A program, and a full year of school funding. The school funding formula is important because school districts will need to plan for their budget. What we're going to do is take my budget proposal, which increased education at about 3.9%. We will do what they call a run from that budget and give school districts what number, the amount they will receive under that budget so they can plan. Whatever the final budget winds up being, it is going to be literally a plus or minus the 3.9%. Not a minus, it'll probably be a little bit of a plus, but for cautious planning, which is what I would ask the school districts to do, they should assume the funding levels that we send them in the run. If the actual budget winds up being a little bit higher, then so be it. But the 3.9%, I think, is a safe planning number, and we will do that by the runs. We have agreement on many items. We have agreement on the millionaire's tax, on a middle-class tax cut, on a water program that was actually passed, on ride-sharing, on college affordability, on workers' comp, on property tax reform and citizen empowerment to get people involved in their state and local taxes and that discussion. We have the agreement on a prescription drug program, which is a first in the nation, on an opioid program, which is a very aggressive program. So we've done a lot of good work. Open issues, raise the age. On raise the age, the last sticking point, the current sticking point, which you can go from sticking point to sticking point across the morass, the current sticking point is who does supervision of people who are discharged from what we call hybrid facilities? Does DOCS Correction do supervision over discharged people, or does OCFS? Raise the age, remember, we've talked about it for many, many years, and it hasn't passed for many, many years, because it really is the most political polarizing issue. Right? Depending on your philosophy, this is can be an ideologically polarizing issue. Criminal justice laws usually are lightning rods for ideological differences. And raise the age poses a very important but controversial theory. What do you do with a 16 and 17-year-old, and how do you treat them? And it may be a 16 and 17-year-old that did a bad act, maybe a 16 and 17-year-old that actually hurt someone. And how do you treat them? Are they a criminal, or should they be locked up? Or do we give them a second chance, and do we try to rehabilitate them? And what is that balance? That's what Raise the Age poses. If you are a Republican conservative, you see it one way. If you are a Democratic liberal, you see it a different way. So that's what Raise the Age has been posing. That is still an open issue. There's an issue with the Affordable New York program, the old 421A program, which sometimes was what they would say linked to rent reform, where they both expired at the same time. They are now separated because of the delay in passing the new Affordable New York plan. So that is an issue of concern more to the Assembly. And then there's an issue of education funding, specifically charter funding. There's always an issue of education funding, how it's distributed. It's especially complicated this year because there is a law that is on the books that concerns charter schools that really throws a wrench into the machine of government. There is a charter school law that has frozen the tuition increase to charter schools for a number of years. That law expires this year in June. When the law expires, charter schools automatically receive a $1,500 increase per student. And that amount is to be paid by the local government. So for example, New York City, the increase would be $1,500 per student. It would be $200 million to New York City. That happens automatically. The $1,500 is a windfall to the charter schools, I would say. Charter schools would say they deserve it because their tuition was frozen for a long period of time, and this is really paying them back for past increases that they didn't receive. But $1,500 per student is a very large number. And it happens automatically. The Assembly is opposed to the $1,500 increase. However, if the Assembly does nothing, inaction automatically gives the charter schools a $1,500 increase. So in other words, it's a unique situation in some ways. If the Assembly does not act, they have actually acted to give charter schools a $1,500 increase. The only way the charter schools don't get a $1,500 increase is if the Senate agrees to pass a new bill that would restrict or reduce that $1,500.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Lawmakers have already approved a 2-month extension of state spending till May 31st, ensuring government continues to function. Lawmakers, meanwhile, aren't scheduled to reconvene until late April after the Easter break. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Well, it came and went. That was the deadline for a state budget, Alan, which is April 1st each year. We've gone through that. We've been witness now to talks blowing up. We're speaking now on a Thursday morning where there's some question as to whether anybody will show up and do anything. The Senate has left. And while Governor Cuomo has said he sees progress on the state budget, with this looming Easter break, looks like it won't get done.
Well, I have a couple of thoughts on this, David. One is that I was terribly amused that the budget really wasn't done by April 1st, which is, of course, April Fool's Day. And the second is that I was amused by an assemblyman who was complaining, and we're all supposed to be so sympathetic, that he'd run out of basically clothes and underwear. And how is that going to be taken care of? These are people who are making, by the time they get all their Lulus and everything, about 100 grand a year. And they're given a daily stipend for every day that they're in Albany. I want to get my violin out and start to play for them. They have to be there a couple of days. Oh, that's terrible. And the rest of the time, they show up on Monday afternoon, maybe Tuesday. They're home by Wednesday. Oh, we work so hard in our districts. Yeah. Sure. Of course. Well, they are all, and everybody knows it, between a rock and a hard place because they don't know what Trump is going to do to New York State. They don't know about Medicaid. Cuomo says, well, I need flexibility. I mean, I need to be able to lower the amount we pay on our Medicaid expenditure if I need to do that. So that tells you everything you need to know, which is that you can't pass a state budget unless you know what the federal allocation is going to be. So that's where they are. On the one hand, you got the Democrats in the assembly. They don't like the guy because he didn't give them a raise that they thought that they deserved, which I don't believe they do, unless they pass ethics reform. I think the governor was right on that one, right on the money. And the Senate doesn't love them because they're Republicans, but only by a vote. And maybe not even that. I read in the paper that one of them says, I'm going to run for sheriff. Yeah, so I'm not going to be a senator anymore. And that does away with the Senate majority. Then you have the so-called traitors, the Independent Democratic Conference, IDC, and you have people like Jeff Klein from the Bronx. Apparently his constituents are waking up and they're saying, wait a second now, we elected you as a big Democrat. What are you doing over there with those Republicans? Why are you helping them? Is it all for a few pounds of silver? What's going on? And now, all of a sudden, the IDC is in a bad spot. But the real question is, what does the governor want? We know that the governor has always liked to, well, play footsie with the Republicans in the Senate. You know, he makes a sound every once in a while that he's really a Democrat and Democrats should be together. But in fact, he hasn't shown any real great penchant for making the IDC side with the Democrats. And why? Well, there are a lot of theories on what's going on with the IDC. Some people think, yeah, it's a racial thing because the Democratic leadership, Andrea Stewart Cousins and others, have color and are of color. And that's what this whole breakaway thing may really be about. Anyway, it's a mess and nobody knows what to do. Of course, the Republicans in the Senate either have to satisfy the demands of the so-called IDC hyphen traitor group or risk losing them, which they really can't afford to do. So they have to be mitigated in their actions somewhat by the fact that they got a bunch of Democrats supporting them and who can't go back to their districts unless they do say that we made a difference with the Republicans. And on the other hand, you got a guy, Cuomo, who's talking about running for president. And when you're running for president, how do you deal with the Senate, which are a bunch of Republicans who probably have somebody, you know, whispering in their ear a bit and telling them, don't make it too easy for this guy. So that's where I think we are.
Meantime, they have passed an extender, which carries them through May 31st. You think they'll try to read what's in the budget between now and then?
Well, we know they don't read it. They can't read it. They put it on their tables, usually with a so-called disgraceful message of necessity, which is there so that if you have a tornado or a giant sea wave, the legislature can meet. Now the message of necessity is used for everything, David. And what do I think is going to happen here? I don't know. It is very hard to figure out.
I'm reading in Syracuse.com, Alan, that defense lawyers have recommended that a federal trial be scheduled no earlier than January 2018 for Joseph Prococo, the former top aide to Governor Andrew Cuomo, charged with corruption, and three other defendants, including Core Development Executive Stephen Aiello and Joseph Girardi. What do you make of that?
Well, the first thing you think of is, okay, how does this fit in with the Cuomo agenda? Now, we know that Preparar, who was bringing this case, was fired by President Trump. So who's making deals with who in order to make this thing happen? Is it better for Trump that if Cuomo was going to oppose him in a presidential election, is it better for the trial to be postponed so that just when Cuomo is peaking and running for governor, this trial comes up, which is expected to seriously embarrass the governor? It is always in the interest of the defense to keep these trials going, and that is what is happening here. But one can't begin not to suspect that some arrangement is going on that is ultimately political.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You're listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. With the U.S. once again debating the future of health care, activists rallied this week in Albany to support a bill that would create a universal publicly financed health insurance plan for all New Yorkers. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas was there.
Rally-goer and Green Party candidate for Albany Mayor Dan Platt believes having a state single-payer plan in place would have a positive impact on local economics.
It reminds me a lot of the anti-fracking movement. Each year, the rally gets a little bit bigger. More partners are made, and more people catch on to the necessity and the importance of this issue in getting this law passed, or this piece of policy done.
The New York Health Act has passed twice in the Assembly, which expects to pass it again for the third year in a row. Assembly Health Committee Chair and bill sponsor Democrat Dick Gottfried says support for universal health care is growing with the public and in the state Senate, where it is co-sponsored by nearly half of all senators. The bill would replace private insurance premiums, deductibles, co-pays, restricted provider networks, and out-of-network charges. It would provide comprehensive health coverage for all New Yorkers, regardless of immigration status, health, or employment status, with full choice of doctors and other providers. Katie Robbins is the executive director of the New York Metro Chapter of Physicians for a national health program.
Studies have shown that if the New York Health Act were passed and implemented, we'd have a healthcare system where 98% of New Yorkers would pay less than they do now for healthcare. Healthcare costs are rising. The average family plan is $18,000 a year. People know that the increasing deductibles and co-pays, I mean, we all know that feeling of if you get sick, you worry, oh, shoot, how am I going to pay for this? Under our system, we pay for it up front through a payroll tax as well as a tax on capital gains. And then when you need to use the system, you don't have to worry about having the money at the time that you get sick. It ends this kind of Byzantine practice of tying your health insurance to your job or your marriage.
The program would be publicly funded based on ability to pay and would eliminate the local share of Medicaid currently funded through county property taxes. Platt insists health care should be considered a basic right nationally and locally.
It will be a great benefit to the city of Albany, all the residents, because it is everybody in, nobody out.
Platt's campaign platform includes economics, the environment, social justice, and human rights. He says New York health affects and is affected by all of these areas. Robbins notes the bill has 30 co-sponsors in the state Senate, two votes short of a majority. Republicans control the chamber in a power-sharing agreement with the Independent Democratic Conference, and it's a long shot to reach the floor for a vote.
I think it would start a trend in the country so that other states would do it, and then eventually we would adopt a national Medicare for All system that will guarantee health care as a right to all residents of this country, and New York can be the first state to do it, start the trend, and lead the way.
A 2015 study by a UMass Amherst professor estimated that the New York Health Act, if implemented, would save almost $45 billion in the first year alone, reducing burdensome billing expenses, administrative waste in the insurance industry, monopolistic pricing of drugs and medical devices, and fraud.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
At a time when voters are increasingly contacting their representatives in Washington, New York Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney recently held a telephone town hall. Constituents in his 18th district asked about topics ranging from immigration to climate change to health care. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn reports.
Maloney, a Democrat, has held telephone town halls throughout his time in office, along with an in-person town hall series called Speak with Sean. His latest telephone gathering found district residents asking about headline news. Dawn from Carmel in Putnam County says she cannot afford monthly health insurance at more than $1,200 for her family, and she and her husband own a small business.
You know, it doesn't make sense. You guys are playing politics at our expense.
Well, what do you mean we're playing politics? I'm not. I'll just tell you right
off
the bat. I know you might feel that way, but I'm not playing politics with it. I wasn't here when they voted for the Affordable Care Act, and I've said from day one I'm not carrying water from anybody on that.
Maloney said the Affordable Care Act could use improvements, but was against Republicans' recently abandoned repeal and replace version.
You're playing politics at everybody's expense.
I'm not playing politics. Honestly, I'm not going to let you get away with that. No, I'm not. I am dead serious about fixing what's wrong with your health care. Well, then stop saying you guys. Say somebody else,
really?
Don, because it's not me. So, I understand you're frustrated, but let me just be clear with you. I'm not going to be silent when they are going to give big tax cuts to the rich and screw people on Medicare, Medicaid, and who rely on Planned Parenthood. So if that's
playing
politics... Well,
I'm glad that you're letting us know that what was in it, because we don't know anything.
Maloney told her of his mom-and-pop shop act, which would make such businesses eligible for small business health options on an exchange. Dawn said that would help, and she wanted to see the bill. Their conversation grew congenial. Meanwhile, White House officials have offered changes to the health care bill in an effort to revive the measure and appeal to conservative House Republicans. Switching topics, Jeff from Campbell Hall in Orange County had a question.
What is your position on President Trump's plan to vet immigrants from the designated Muslim countries?
Right. Well, look, I support vetting refugees. We do that. I don't like the approach that the Trump administration has taken, which started out, you know, as an explicit Muslim ban, became a sort of partial Muslim ban, has now kind of been watered down into sort of a kind of Muslim ban.
President Trump issued an executive order in March revising a previous executive order on travel and immigration. Maloney continued with his answer.
I'm not going to participate in whipping people up and scaring you about threats that I don't think are real. I think the real threat is in the visa waiver program, where we've got millions of people coming in on visas, overstaying them. That's a much easier way to get in the country and to cause mischief or worse. And that's where I'd put my focus.
And Paul from Somers in Westchester County offered a suggestion.
My first thing is please repeal the taxes on Social Security or redo the form that you have to fill out for your taxes because it's ridiculous to do. I mean,
got it. Yeah, I've heard about that.
Adding here, deducting there. The other thing is I'm a former Marine. I was stationed in Camp Lejeune.
The triple cancer survivor had filed a health claim with the Veterans Administration that has not advanced, and Maloney said his staff would help, as they have with a number of constituent issues concerning the VA. Callers raised other topics such as student loan debt, funding for a new local firehouse, and nomination of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1714. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at the same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.